Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to the second quarter wrap-up. We're going to be talking about news, trends, and stories with Dr. Joseph Farrell, as we do every quarter. It's one of our most popular Solari reports. We have four sections this evening: economy and financial markets, geopolitics, science and technology, and the big questions. And part one is going to be the first two, economy and financial markets and geopolitics. And then part two, which will run next week, will be science and technology and the big questions. So before we invite Dr. Farrell in, I wanted to just remind you again of the introduction quote to the second quarter wrap-up. The debt finance growth model has reached its limits. There are no shortcuts that aren't reforms. And that's from the German finance minister at the G20 meeting in Shanghai. And then for the news, trends, and stories, the quote from the CEO of ING Group, one of the largest financial institutions of Europe, quote, "We've interviewed about 2,000 of our clients and we got a very sobering message from them. They said, well, you should realize that we all need banking, but we don't need banks." Well, and with that, let me introduce Dr. Joseph Farrell, who needs no introduction here. Joseph, I have to say, until a week ago, this was looking to be the most fascinating wrap-up of news, trends, and stories we've had to date. And with Brexit, it looks like it's the most momentous we've ever had.
Oh, yeah, it's huge. It's huge. It's just, and thanks for having me back on, but yeah, it's huge. There's no way of slicing this other than, it's at least a major event, and depending on how you approach an analysis of this thing, this is, to my mind, Catherine, this is either a huge defeat for Mr. Global, or it's another indicator of what I've been arguing, that there's some real serious factional infighting, fissures, and cracks going on in the globalist agenda. This is just huge. There's no two ways about it.
Right. Well, I would say this is the beginning of the end for the unipolar world.
Yeah, I do too. I really think that. It's the end of the American attempt to completely keep Europe under the thumb. Britain isn't going to go along with it, and you can't blame them. There's a lot of factors in play here. EU, you know, the cost of EU regulations that you and I talked about a great length on Sunday. You've got a bunch of unelected commissioners in Brussels who are handing down regulations that everybody has to abide by. And this is what most people don't understand, particularly in the United States. They tend to think of the EU as a legitimate democratic federation. It's not. It's an unelected set of bureaucrats in Brussels that are basically dictating to, you know, to the rest of Europe. And this means that there's an undue influence and weight given to French and German commissioners. And of those two countries, we know which one's in the driver's seat. And for Britain, you know, for Britain, I think this is a long-term gain. I really do. I think what you have now is an opportunity for Britain to act on its own. I think we're going to see some very aggressive diplomacy coming out of Britain. I've been arguing this on my own website. I think we're going to see some very aggressive diplomacy, some very aggressive trade deals come out of them. I think what you're also going to see, and this is something I would advise people in the Commonwealth countries, Canada and Australia, New Zealand, and so on, to look for, is I think you're going to see Britain play the soft power card with the Commonwealth, absolutely. And this is going to create some interesting investment opportunities. I think Britain's tired of American leadership and for America representing the English-speaking world, let's put it that way, culturally. I think they're tired of that. They're tired of the multiculturalism. So the Brexit vote wasn't a surprise to me at all, Catherine.
Right. So let's step back and go through some of the different reasons for this vote.
Right.
Because I think it's very important. And I would say, if I had to, I've got about five or six reasons, I think, because this was a multivariate equation that was driving it. But I would say number one is the preservation of culture. And this is something you've talked about for years. You know, if anybody's pounded this drum, it's you. And I think the Brits are absolutely moving to preserve their culture. So maybe if you could describe that.
Well, the bottom line here is Islamic culture is not compatible with a Judeo-Christian, Western European, humanistic culture. We've got those three influences at work in our culture. A long, prolonged history of the effect and influence of religion and theology on the development of our institutions, and particularly our law. And then in addition to that, you have the Renaissance and Enlightenment influences with, an emphasis on humanism and individual freedom and creativity, and certainly a large part of that comes out of the Protestant Reformation as well. So you've got a cultural conflict here that simply is not going to be solvable by allowing people to live in medieval barbaric ghettos and practicing, a form of medieval law and, quite frankly, brutality. It's in terms of Western cultural mores, it's very, very demeaning to women. You've got all of this in play, and I think I think that kind of multiculturalism is simply poisonous to any nation or civilization that wants to go down that path. And I think most people in Britain realize that and just sent a resounding no that, you're welcome to assimilate to this culture, but you're not welcome to impose a system of law, a system of morality on this culture in the name of what is essentially a backward, medieval, unreconstructed, unreformed religion. So I think that's hugely in play here. But I think there's some other things culturally, too, that are in play. I think that there have been cultural consequences to this idea of Mr. Global and the unipolar world, where everything's going to be run by multinational corporations rather than sovereign nation states. Well, if we look at the Brexit vote from that second point of view, and I have been arguing this on my website, if you look at the Brexit vote from that point of view, I think it's a referendum on the colossal failure of Mr. Global in this respect. They have proven themselves to be people that view the laws and institutions of the countries that they're in and operating in with contempt. They have viewed themselves as above the law. They've viewed themselves as grand manipulators, to use Zbigniew Brzezinski's phrase, of the grand chessboard, without due regard for the culture and institutions that they're in. So I think this was a referendum on that philosophy within the globalist vision. I don't necessarily think that you can have a globalist vision, but I don't necessarily think it must necessarily exclude the idea of the sovereignty of the individual or of the locality, and more importantly, of the nation and its culture.
Right.
So I think it was a huge vote on that as well. I think that's the second kind of influence that was percolating. At least this was the feeling, Catherine, I was getting from members of my own website that live in the United Kingdom, and many as well that live elsewhere in Europe watching it. So, I think this vote is going to spread. On the day it happened, I was literally flooded with emails from members in France and the Netherlands and Denmark and Austria and so on that were applauding the vote. So in other words, it was a very popular vote in the rest of Europe among, right, basic middle class Europeans.
I don't know if you realize, but 80% of the US, the latest poll before the vote was 80% of the U.S. supported leave.
Yeah. Yeah. You've got the same sentiment here.
Right.
This was a referendum on the track record of Mr. Global. And let's face it, if we look at the track record of Mr. Global ever since the Clinton administration and the deregulation of the banks and the deregulation of the media and so on and so forth, it's been a track record of colossal fraud. It's been a track record, in my opinion, of colossal failure, both geopolitically and financially. We've seen the bailouts and the quantitative easing and so on and so forth. So it's a referendum on that. And I think the Brexit vote, in a certain sense, the Brexit vote was a national vote that reflected a growing international consensus within various Western countries. And this to me is why the phenomenon, I think, is legitimate. I think it's a legitimate setback for that kind of globalism. And I think there's some other influences, deeper influences at work in this vote. I think that Britain and the British deep state, let's put it that way, are very well aware of two fundamental problems, and that is, you know, we both discussed The Economist magazine last year running that op-ed piece about the calcification of the American political class, you know, at the time Jeb Bush and Hillary Clinton were the front runners. And, you know, if you're across the pond and you're an ally like Great Britain looking at this phenomenon, you've got to be thinking, you're kidding. You know, you can't do any better than running the same old thing game that you've been playing for the last 30 years. So, you know, this, if you're Britain looking at that, you're thinking there's no new solutions here. There's no new thinking here. It's just the same old, and it's not working. So I think it's a revolt in that sense, looking at American unipolarism. Britain can do much better outside the EU and on its own in terms of negotiating directly with countries like China and Russia and so on. And I think it's also...
Well, remember when the Chinese premier came and spent a fair amount of time with the Brits and had dinner with the Queen? And
yes.
You and I talked about there's a deal here because...
Yes. Absolutely.
If you look at the Commonwealth countries, they are all, you know, suddenly right now, they are surpassing in trade with China what they're doing with the United States. So if you look at the New Zealand balance of trade, the Canadian balance of trade, the Australian balance of trade, the UK,
right.
You know, they are at a crossroads in terms of which way do they go. And my impression was the TPP and the transatlantic agreement were going to be the U.S.'s ways of tying them back into the American alliance with, you know, the traditional Anglo-American alliance. And in fact, that stalled with the election. And now we basically, we see the Brits taking the Commonwealth, I think, and reinvigorating, and you used the right word, soft power, reinvigorating the old empire trade lines.
It's not only that, but I think those trade agreements, quite frankly, Catherine, particularly the Transatlantic Investment and Trade Partnership, which one of my website members called a terribly bad investment plan, you know. But if you look at the response to this now spreading in Europe, I think that whole thing is dead. It's dead if it's not fundamentally renegotiated with terms much more favorable to Europe. There is tremendous pushback against it in France. I think this will spread to the rest of Europe. Probably the only country that is going to support it more or less half-heartedly would be Germany. But even then, I don't think the Germans, you know, they've just inked several billion dollars worth of deals with the Chinese. And behind the scenes, you know, they're quietly negotiating with the Russians. So the whole economic situation is driving a fundamental change geopolitically. I think that trade deal is dead. But I think at the fourth level, Catherine, the Brexit vote was really a vote against the incipient fascism, if I can be very blunt and frank, of the European Union. It was a vote against the German dominance of the continent. And in that sense, again, you can't blame the Britons. They fought two world wars after all. So, you know, from that point of view, again, it makes a great deal of historical sense. And there's much more to be gained, as you pointed out, that their trade is growing with China. And my guess is, you know, I don't know that much about what sort of trade that the Commonwealth nations are conducting with China, but my guess is it's not all Walmarts.
Right. I really wonder if, in part, if you look at the timing of this, the Brits aren't trying to get out ahead of a couple of big hot potatoes, one of which is a European bank bailout, because we've seen the banks, if you look at the trading patterns of both the UK and the European banks, clearly they're coming into something that's going to need to be done this year.
Yep.
And so, you know, including the possibility that Greece gets moved out of the EU.
Yep.
So that's coming. But the other thing that's coming is an explosion in the general population in Europe about immigration.
Yes, absolutely.
And here's my question. Is it Germany that's pushing the immigration, or is it the Vatican?
Well, I've pondered this immigration problem for a long time. Germany, to be sure, or rather Chancellor Merkel, because it's equally unpopular with many Germans as it is elsewhere in Europe.
Right.
It's really Merkel and again the globalist bureaucrats at Brussels that have been behind this. And I have had suspicions as well. There have been a number of internet stories. I haven't had the time to pursue them or verify them, but there were a number of internet stories that to some extent, this was being driven out of Silicon Valley in the United States with tweets on Twitter and social media, you know, telling people in the Middle East and Africa, you know, well, go move to Europe, you know, you can get benefits there and things like this, to swamp Europe with an immigration and social programs crisis, you know, basically keep their economies in chaos and therefore under the American thumb. My other scenario is I have been entertaining is the idea that if you're going to create a genuine Europe, you have to create a European sense of identity and culture rather than simply a French or a German or an Austrian or a Norwegian sense of identity. And the way you do that is you bring in a completely alien and foreign and, let's be honest, barbaric and brutal culture, and expose your people to it, to create a backlash, to create that sense of togetherness and belonging in something that you possess in common that they don't. So I've been viewing the immigration crisis there as perhaps having been deliberately orchestrated for precisely that cultural purpose, and we certainly do see the backlash now in Europe with the growth of political parties and movements on the political right in Europe that are giving voice to the idea of, you know, our fundamental European values of a Judeo-Christian humanistic civilization are now under assault by this invasion. And we have to understand something here. There are two manifestations of this in Europe. One is an extreme right wing kind of neo-fascist, neo-Nazi sort of pagan revival. I don't know what else to call it. And we've certainly seen some of that happen. But for the most part, the more serious political movements are not catering to that and in fact carefully avoiding any rhetoric or language that would even suggest that. You've got much more serious politicians in the Netherlands with Geert Wilders and with some people in France and Germany supporting this idea of closing the borders and, you know, if you're willing to assimilate, fine, you're welcome to stay, but if not, out you go.
Do you think, Joseph, that there's any chance that the Brits are trying to get out ahead of the Americans trying to start a war with Russia?
Yes, I do. Yes, I do. I think this was a vote also at a fourth and deepest fundamental level. I think this was a vote against American unipolarism.
Right.
If you look at the rhetoric and the nuttiness coming out of Washington with respect to Russia, it's Catherine, there's just no other way to qualify it other than as insanity. Russia's not planning to invade Eastern Europe or, you know, anybody else anytime soon. But if they think, you know, that they can muscle Russia and make it kowtow to their orders and threaten it, that they've got another thing coming. It's just not going to happen. And I think in Britain, if you're looking at these developments, especially at how America has so wretchedly botched its presence in the Middle East since 9/11 and basically destabilized the entire region. I think if you're looking at that from the British point of view, with their long-standing interests in that area, that you've got to be dismayed, and you've basically come to the realization that you can't simply go along with everything that Washington says anymore. You've got to strike out on your own. And Britain, the reason I think the Commonwealth is very important here is that Britain on its own is a powerful economy. It's certainly, you know, it's certainly a world power still. It's a nuclear power, obviously. But with the Commonwealth as well, it carries, you know, it carries a leadership position within the Commonwealth. And if that institution can be revivified in a soft power sort of way, Britain will carry a lot of weight in the world. And
yes,
in the long term, you know, there's going to be, Mr. Global's already, you know, stomped his feet and whined and pouted and done what he can to punish, you know, punish Great Britain as a result of this. So in the short to midterm, it's going to be a little bumpy for them. But in the long term,
well, but here's the thing,
well,
you know, because you know, I believe Mr. Global did Snowden and Putin and everything to try and encourage a little competition, because the unipolar model wasn't going fast enough.
Right.
And so if you look at the extent to which he's shaken it up and been moving it to a multipolar world, to a certain extent, he's much better off with Britain in the lead than the U.S.
Oh, yes, absolutely. Absolutely. Britain is able to articulate a more traditional Western cultural value system than is the United States. You know, Britain isn't exporting McDonald's and bad music to the rest of the world. You know me and my music fetish, but anyway. But it's true. You know, Britain isn't going to be doing things like this, and British diplomacy has a long tradition. It's very skilled at what they do, and I think we're going to see some very, very aggressive diplomacy coming out of them. What's interesting and intriguing to me, Catherine, is that, you know, before the Brexit vote, President Obama was telling, you know, Britain that if you do this, well, you're just going to go to the back of the queue, you know, as far as trade with the United States is concerned. And now, after the vote, Secretary Kerry is over there in Europe reaffirming the special relationship and so on and so forth. So in other words, I think the American deep state is very worried about some of these possibilities.
Well, they should be very worried. A couple more points I wanted to bring up. You told me a story about the Queen, which I would love for you to share with our subscribers.
Oh, yeah. This was something. There were three clues to me, Catherine, as I was watching this vote loom, that indicated to me that there was a very good possibility that the Brexit vote would go through. The first was that op-ed piece in The Economist magazine that you pointed out to me last July about the calcification of the American political class. The second clue for me, and it was a huge one, was when Britain jumped right on the bandwagon to become a board member of China's Asia Infrastructure Investment Bank. That was a huge clue that something large was quietly going on and was in the works in the background. But the third clue for me, the one that really kind of clinched it, was a few months ago, I think it was just a couple months, Queen Elizabeth II invited a bunch of British dignitaries, including the Vice Premier, to the palace for dinner. And the topic of conversation, as it turned out, for dinner was that the Queen was asking the various people, especially pointedly at the Vice Premier, who of course represented the Cameron government, which wanted to stay in, was, you know, name me three good reasons to stay in the EU. Now, if you know anything about British politics, that's the monarchy's way of saying, we're really not in favor of this, and you might want to rethink your policy. Well, this got out, you know, when the Queen asks you for tea, you go, you know. So this got out into the British tabloids, and, you know, it created somewhat of a minor firestorm. And I thought that in itself was a huge clue that something was in the works, because the monarchy, as you and I know, the monarchy is very wealthy. The British royal family is very wealthy. They exercise a great deal of influence behind the scenes in politics in Great Britain. Right. And, you know, and in addition to this, they represent tradition, you know, just good old-fashioned British culture. So I looked at all these three
Well,
things, Catherine,
I would
and I
point
just
something
thought, it's
out.
coming.
Yes, they're very wealthy, but they are also, if you look at the investment pools that they control, as well as the flotilla of endowments
Right.
and philanthropic pools of capital and family offices that follow them, they're the lead ship, and there's an enormous, and if you look at the accumulated position, lead position in major corporations that those pools of capital represent,
Right.
what I dare say is that it's one of the reasons I believe that the EU regulation was really cutting
Yes,
into the
exactly.
cash flows. Right.
Exactly. Well,
Right.
I've said this many times too. I suspect that this was the Queen's way of trying to head off what may have been a looming constitutional crisis, because, and I say this for the American audience more than for the Commonwealth audience that will already know this. But Americans have this idea that the British monarch is simply a figurehead, and this is simply
No.
not true. The
Right. It's not
monarch,
true.
a bill, Parliament can pass all the bills of law that it wants to, but until the Queen signs it, it's not a law. They're still the chief executive in Great Britain,
Right.
and there is nothing within the English Constitution to compel the monarch to sign a bill of Parliament into law. So, in other words, they do have a tacit pocket veto power that they haven't exercised, of course, in centuries, but that doesn't prevent them from doing so. So it may have been a way on her part and the monarchy's part to head off what may have been a looming, constitutional crisis if
No, it's
Mr.
very
Chamberlain had
interesting
gone
because
through.
it takes 2 years to leave the EU,
Right.
obviously, and there's plenty of negotiation and complexity in that process. And it doesn't begin until they file their Form 50. What's interesting today is Cameron indicated that they were going to proceed to file.
Right.
And he's not waiting for the next, for his replacement, apparently, to
Right.
proceed, is what it sounds like. So, a decision has been made, and
Yep.
we've seen the Brits reverse path anytime, against the will of the people before. So for some reason it's not happening. So that's why I bring up the Queen. I also wanted to bring up a couple of other points. One is one of the things that I really took that really gave me the signal was it was not just the meeting with the Chinese, it was there was a whole series of articles in The Economist warning about this, including one after the calcification of the American aristocracy, saying that the US dollar was dangerous and dominant. And the
Right.
clear indication was, stop. There's too many sticks here and not enough carrots, so you better be careful. So there've
Right,
been plenty
exactly.
of warnings, but one of the warnings I took very seriously was the Waroker trilogy.
Yes.
Because when you deeply offend the British intelligence services,
Right.
you got a big problem.
Well, when you're offending the British intelligence services, MI5 and MI6, when you're offending them, you're essentially offending the Home Office, which is essentially the British Interior Ministry, and also the closely allied with the Foreign Ministry. You're offending the British Deep State. You're offending those more traditional elements within both the Labour and Tory parties. So, yeah, it was a huge faux pas, and there's so much in that trilogy to indicate that it's based on fact, with the allusions to Prime Minister Blair and his relationship with President Bush.
Right.
There's too many allusions in that, and that was another.
And I think, frankly, I think given what happened under the Clintons, I think the Brits were
Yeah.
looking at Clinton versus Trump and saying, I don't want howdy or duty. Right.
Exactly. They've seen the geopolitical handwriting on the wall, and they've decided that this is the moment and opportunity that they need to strike out on their own. And this is why I think that Britain, you're going to see Britain try to make the best that it can out of its Commonwealth relationships. And I think
Right.
there's going to be a lot of diplomacy now between Britain and the other Commonwealth countries to present as much of a united front as they can in terms of the soft power card. And in this
So,
respect, I think it's very interesting. I think they're taking a cue from President Putin and Prime Minister Orban in Hungary in a certain way, because they've been saying the same thing. You cannot have a genuinely multipolar world where the rights and sovereignties of nation states are not taken into account. In other words, they've been taking direct aim at the globalist dogma that corporations and altruistic central bankers like David Rockefeller are going to run everything.
Right.
So I think Britain has just joined that chorus.
Now, one of the factors that you and I both think is involved is Nazi International. Maybe if you could just touch on that.
Well, this is I think the deepest disturbing thing about the motivations behind the Brexit vote and what the motivations of the British deep state may have been. Because, as I pointed out in my book, The Third Way, if you look at the structure of the European Union and how it was basically cobbled together very quickly and very secretly by Chancellor Kohl and the then French President Valéry Giscard d'Estaing, if you look at the structure of the European Union, it is essentially, almost detail for detail, the working out of a Nazi plan that was published in 1942 in Berlin, and it was a document sponsored by IG Farben. In other words, and very clearly, if you study this thing,
right,
it was recommended that they simply bypass national legislatures by creating an international regulatory bureaucracy that would have total control over the movement of capital, over the movement of labor, the standards of production, agriculture, everything, and do so by regulatory fiat. And this is exactly
John
what
Laughlin
saw
wrote
emerge.
A fabulous book about this called The Tainted Source.
Yes.
About
the
EU.
Exactly.
Right.
Exactly. So I think this was also in the thinking of the British deep state that, you know, we can't possibly be a part of something that has that kind of background and doesn't really have anything within that structure to protect the local nation or even localities within a nation, much less the individual rights and liberties that Western civilization has struggled so long to secure. You know, the EU is a threat to all of this, I'll be very blunt. And, you know, we're certainly seeing that in the way that Germany has been basically dictating to countries like Italy or Greece and so on and so forth. So I think, again, the British made the correct decision. In a certain sense, if you go back to a Briton by the name of Christopher Story, who was trying to, he's now passed away, but he was trying to alert Britons to the dangers of the European Union and pointing out precisely the ultimately Nazi origins of many of its institutions. And I think in a certain sense, this is his vindication, this vote, because I do think the British deep state was very aware of these things and very concerned.
Last point. Right after Brexit passes,
mm-hmm.
Standard & Poor's announces
yes.
that they are dropping Britain's rating from a AAA to a AA+, which is in fact the U.S. rating. S&P dropped the U.S. about 5 or 6 years ago, and when they did, shortly thereafter, reasonably time thereafter, the Department of Justice went after Standard & Poor's.
Yep. Yeah.
So my guess is at this point, you know, whatever the administration wants of Standard & Poor's, they do. And this is basically a message. Think of, you know, for more than a century, the Anglo-American alliance has ruled the financial world together.
Yep.
And this is basically one side of the Siamese twins declaring war and saying, oh, no, you're not going to have... You're not going to be independent of us with a cheaper cost of capital than we have. We're going to raise your cost of capital across the board at the worst moment.
Right, right. It's a financial declaration of war, and again, I think that the British deep state knew that this was coming. I think that they were planning for it, as you pointed out, the meeting with President Xi Jinping of China and his meeting with the Queen and other British elites. This was in the cards. They knew it was going to come. I think, again, Britain positioning itself in the Asian Infrastructure Investment Bank was a key strategic move. I think that's, in retrospect, in hindsight, I think that move signals the fact that they knew that Britain was going to bolt from the EU for some time. They're going to bypass it with trade deals with China and so on and so forth. So I don't think they're that concerned. Anyway, I'm sorry.
So unless you have phenomenal space weaponry that we don't even understand or know about, to me, this is the beginning of the end of the U.S. reserve currency status.
Yeah, I agree.
You know, it's going to take a real rabbit to pull it out of the hat at this point. So I don't know how many years we have to adjust, but here it is. Okay, well, Brexit, momentous times, and we're just going to be watching throughout the third and fourth quarter. We'll know a lot more about what it means as things evolve. So let's move quickly to some of the other areas in the global financial thing, and not unconnected to the powerful forces of decentralization. We're in a global slowdown, and it's global, and it's happening in the United States, and it's happening globally. Maybe if you could say a little bit about that.
Well, I think the slowdown, my model of this, and again, I'm not a student of finance or economy to the extent that you are by any stretch of the imagination. So my analysis is predicated on my basic model that we've been looking at infighting within Mr. Global's circles for quite some time. And I think you can boil that infighting down to two models: the centralization model, which is the model that, you know, the Rockefellers, the Rothschilds, if you want to name names, would be operating under. And then you've got the Young Turks that see this more as a unipolar world, not so much clustered around corporations, but for that matter, global institutions, but rather clustered around a basic philosophy and an approach to things that emphasizes the locality. And
right.
I think you're seeing little hints of this surface from time to time in the various European countries where you hear about movements of secession from the nations that they're in, Catalonia and Spain and so on and so forth, even Venice and Italy. You're seeing a discontent with the centralized superstate, because the centralized superstate, again, going back to what you've pointed out with the EU, the cost of regulation is making business and real growth impossible. So this is what I think is going on here.
One thing that may have impacted Brexit is we've had the central banks and the big banks looking at blockchain and what it can do.
Right.
And I literally can see the Bank of England saying, you know, we're better off out, you know, just with
right.
the Commonwealth, because
right.
this thing is going to be powerfully decentralizing.
Yeah, it is. And I think this is really the reason for the slowdown, Catherine. You've sucked so much liquidity out of the hands of you know, the middle class, the people that are going to drive an economy. You've sucked so much out of them in the past decade or so, that the slowdown isn't going to turn around until the centralization model is broken. And this is why we're seeing the failure now. And I think you're absolutely right. We're going to see some major banking upheaval in Europe of some sort, and there's going to be reforms. And, you know, let's just be honest. Let's put the warning out there right now. If the reform is more centralization, it's not a reform. It's not a genuine reform. That's the bottom line.
Okay, so Global 3.0 rises, and what's amazing is I'm going to be talking a lot about this in our big theme in the second quarter wrap-up, but we're having an explosion of technological innovation, but it's not adding
yes.
anything yet to productivity.
Right, right. And the reason it isn't is, again, people don't have the money to invest in it. You know, let's look at my scenario of Mr. Trump here for a moment, because I think this speaks directly to what may be happening in terms of an analysis of American politics right now, which I know that the rest of the world is also watching very closely. If you look at Trump, in my opinion, what he represents to me is a segment of the American deep state that is very, very pissed off about the way the rest of the American deep state has been running things. And that segment of the American deep state that has been hit hard by the drying up of leisure capital and liquidity in the hands of the middle class to go spend in their casinos.
Right.
And that deep state would be the mafia.
Right.
So I think you're looking here at really a candidacy that's coming from a segment of the American deep state that realizes you can't keep running things the way you've been running because it's killing the economy and it's killing their bottom line.
Right.
So he represents, again, to me, this idea of factional infighting that's going on. Hillary Clinton, on the other hand, represents, you know, what we've been seeing and dealing with for the past 30 years. And a track record of failure. And I'm not trying to endorse Trump here. Please don't get me wrong.
Right.
But again, you can't make all these new technologies and expect them to go anywhere unless there's people that have the money to afford them and utilize them. And this is the problem. You can't have Elon Musk's, you know, energy efficient cars costing over $250,000. It's just not going to work. You have to reinvigorate production, and you have to put liquidity back in the hands of people so that they can spend money on the things that you're producing. This is the problem, and that's not going to happen from centralized solutions. I'm sorry.
Well, in fact, artificial intelligence and robotics are moving faster than I think even the leadership expected.
Yeah, they are.
So if anything, it's going to get much worse before it gets better.
Yeah, I think in terms, let's put it this way, Catherine, I think if you're looking particularly for investment purposes at these technologies, you have to be aware of two things that are going to happen here. The technologies are there now, but the problem is they're not going to be brought into a wider role in our culture and in our daily life until people have the money that can afford to buy and utilize these technologies. So in other words, we're looking at technologies that could come online now and would be online if the economy was healthy. But I don't see the economy picking up really in a robust way, in a healthy way, for maybe a decade. So it's going to delay these technologies. We'd already see much more of them than we're seeing if the economy wasn't so bad, is what I'm saying. So, you know, choose your options here very, very carefully, because in the long term, I think they'd be good. But for the short term and mid term, I'm thinking, you know, until Mr. Global wakes up and understands they've got to restore rule of law, they've got to restore some trust, they've got to move away from this central model, and they've got to move away from this model of no place for the nation state or no place for culture. Until this happens, the economy is going to remain moribund.
Right. Let's turn to some of the hot potatoes. Negative interest rates. We now have over $10 trillion of sovereign bonds trading at a negative interest rate in the market. Forget what the central banks are doing.
Right.
And we've gone, you know, since 2000, we've gone from dollar borrowings around the world from $2 trillion to over $10 trillion. Here's the question. Could the U.S. Treasuries go to negative interest rates? Is that feasible?
Catherine, you've got me. Again, what I know about finance, I can write on the back of a postage stamp. But here's my fear. We've seen negative interest rates already in Japan. I don't know if that's affected their bond market yet. There has been talk about negative interest rates in Europe. There's another factor looming on the horizon, I think, in terms of if you're looking at the bond markets, particularly in Europe. There's another factor that people need to be aware of, and that is that Deutsche Bank's stock is way down. It is awash in bad paper and derivatives. So something's going to blow in Europe, and it's going to require, again, you know, it's going to require some major banking overhaul in Europe. And again, if the result is more centralization, then yeah, you might see negative interest rates on bonds. U.S. Treasuries, on the other hand, personally, I don't think you're going to see negative interest rates, but any return that you're going to see on them, especially now that we have the Brexit to deal with and a collapsing alliance system and a looming presidential election, it's going to be low. Let's just put it that way. And it may go into negative. I don't know.
The Feds have said they were going to bump interest rates. You know, first they said they were going to do it once a quarter. Now they're coming out and saying, well, we were going to do it in the fall. Now it looks like, if anything, they may cut this year. So, you know, clearly anybody hoping to get yields on their bonds, it's, you know, it's not going to be anytime soon.
Right. Exactly.
Right. I want to talk about productivity and something we, again, is going to be the theme for the second quarter wrap-up, so subscribers are going to be hearing a lot more about it. But if you look at the conversation that happened at the World Economic Forum last year, what they said is if you needed to get productivity up, you had to get it up in healthcare, education, and government reengineering. And here's my prediction. Here's my prediction. Are you ready?
Yeah, I'm ready.
That they're not going to get productivity up. What they're going to apply the definition of productivity they've been using to re-engineer corporate process.
Right.
Which is you make everything explicit, you digitize it into Silicon Valley and robots, you cut out all the labor costs, and that's going to make it, the process is going to be more centralized and re-engineered, and it's going to create, you know, a dramatic decrease in productivity from the human point of view.
Yep, exactly.
I'm sure it's going to be more productive from Mr. Gates's point of view, but who's going to make a lot more money. It's basically creating monopolies that get paid by mandated payments. It's using government to create fake monopolies, and it's going to be, that's why I call it a cock-up. The greatest cluster, you know what, and it's going to, if you think Brexit was, you know, a revolt, when you see this.
Oh, yeah, there is going to be such a revolt, you know, and I'm glad you raised the healthcare and education components in this, because their model of productivity, I can tell you right now, isn't going to work. You can't have a robot coming in and checking your temperature and giving you your medicine and changing the ID. I'm sorry. You know, if you're on a morphine drip or something, you know, would you trust it to a robot? No, thank you. You're still going to need the human touch, and it's obvious in healthcare. I mean, you know, we need to think of that obviousness as applied to education. I'm sorry, robots, computers, and so on in the classroom. They're nice to have, certainly. They are wonderful tools. You can certainly use them educationally. So, you know, I'm not a Luddite here, but the bottom line is, if you want to transmit the key monuments of our culture, human contact, human mentorship, real teachers and professors that really know their disciplines, are absolutely essential to the process. It cannot.
Well, it's almost like they're trying to design something where they say morphogenic fields don't exist, human intelligence doesn't exist, shared intelligence doesn't exist. There's no such thing as emotional intelligence.
Yes,
it's, you know, this is, I mean, if I didn't know better, I think Mr. Global was a machine who didn't know better.
Well, I think to a certain extent, Mr. Global is a machine who doesn't know better. You know, this I keep going back to the fact that the elites expose themselves to their own nutty progressive education philosophies. John D. Rockefeller sent his sons, I mentioned this in the Common Core book that will be coming out in August, that sent his sons to one of these progressive schools, and the result was they ended up not being able to read or enjoy reading very well. So in other words, you know, you end up with an elite, and there have been articles appearing now recently in the American press about this very subject. You end up with quote-unquote educated people with their degrees that are fundamentally not only arrogant but stupid on top of it.
So let's go to the U.S. budget, because while we've been re-engineering corporate process to be more and more efficient, we've been subsidizing everything with a negative return on investment to taxpayers, and having the taxpayers pick up the tab for massive and greater externality. So I would say we've been driving productivity down for a long time. We've just been able to hide it with more debt. So now that's coming to a head. The debt game isn't going to work, particularly if we're going to lose reserve currency status. So now we come into, presumably there'll be an election, we'll go to inauguration, and now we're going to have to face the reality of the U.S. budget hot potato. What's going to happen?
Yep. Oh, man, I wish I knew. I'm very serious here, Catherine. I don't have a crystal ball.
See, this is why Paul Ryan doesn't want to run for president. He wants to run away.
Yeah.
He wants to run away from home.
Yeah, well, you know, those idiots in Congress on both sides of the aisle, they haven't got a clue. They're not going to be able to fix any of this. Here's the problem.
You cannot fix this without ending the secrecy on the black budget.
Bingo.
Right.
You must have a financial system that is, first of all, transparent. You must have a system of rules of law applicable to all. You can't have state legislatures, like I just heard in California, exempting themselves from the gun control laws that they want to impose on everybody else. You can't have a Congress exempting itself from a health care system that it wants to impose on everybody else. If you're going to have a system of laws, it has to work for everybody, because if it doesn't work for everybody, what you're doing is you're creating fundamental mistrust in the system. And when there's mistrust in the system, what happens is people hoard what liquidity they have. They don't want to spend it because they're worried that something else is going to hit them from the elites and the social engineers and so on and so forth. So, you know, they hoard money. They don't go out and spend. And if they're not spending, you're not having productivity. So my guess is,
one of the things I truly wonder is whether the Brits are looking at what we're doing with space weapons and saying, you know, we're going to pull the plug before they got a Death Star on all of us.
Yeah, exactly. I think that's a part of it. And listen, since you mentioned that, it's very interesting to me. I didn't blog about this, but I read an article in the last week that India launched in 1 week.
Right.
Launched 26 satellites.
Right.
Now,
if you look at the Indian space program, it's building unbelievably rapidly, and their ability to provide it at significant lower cost than what we're doing per launch is unbelievable.
But the breathtaking thing to me here is to pull off a launch schedule like that.
Right.
Requires an extremely efficient management system. It requires an extremely sophisticated infrastructure and logistical system.
Right.
It requires an extremely sophisticated production system. But what it signaled to me also was they're in a hurry to build out something.
Right.
And again, you look at similar launch schedules going on in China and Russia now and the European Space Agency and some of the ambitious projects that they're talking about. They know that they've got to get up there and get up there, you know, with force majeure and do so quickly. So I think this is all connected. I think you're absolutely right here on this score.
Right.
But the U.S. budget... I heard that Mr. Trump today gave a speech to some Ohio miners where he is hoping and promising to renegotiate all these free trade agreements and negotiate them in a more favorable way to the American worker. So in other words, that does tell me he's thinking production here.
Right.
Now, whether or not he's going to be successful or not, but at least he's thinking broadly in terms of the right ideas. But I don't see
his problem is he's in a legal structure where the assets have been moved out and tons of liabilities have been moved in.
Right.
He's got the liabilities. He's got assets, but he doesn't begin to have what he needs. If he's still the reserve currency, he's fine. But if he loses reserve currency status, he's really in trouble. Which brings me to the pension fund hot potato, because that's part of the U.S. budget hot potato. Is you've got the pension funds who went along and financed the housing bubble, you know, and I believe have lost trillions playing the game in the financial coup d'etat, you know, the pump and dump of the stock market, the financing of the housing bubble, and all the monies that was lost on that. So now everybody's saying, oh, you know, we don't have enough money because yields are low. Well,
yes,
you know, it was 2 decades of financial fraud, but now it's followed up with low yields.
Well, I think inevitably, Catherine, what's going to happen is regardless of who gets elected, let's assume for a moment that it's Mr. Trump. Mr. Trump will not be able to do everything that he may intend to do simply because he's got to contend with Congress. And those people are clueless. And they're clueless not only because they're stupid, they're clueless because there's no transparency in the system.
Right.
So, you know, they can have all their congressional committee hearings they want to about this or that aspect of the federal budget, and most of what they're going to be told isn't including, as you've pointed out numerous times, isn't being inclusive in a genuinely transparent way of the massive size of the black budget, not even taking into account my idea of a hidden financial system. So,
right, and absolutely there's a hidden system of finance, and it's growing.
Yeah.
It just got $40 trillion of hard, cold cash.
Yeah, exactly. So I think what's going to happen is, by hook or by crook, you're going to see the financial capital system come to a point where it becomes obvious that it is not capable of resolving the problem. And once that happens, once people in localities wake up that the system is failing and failing them, then the issue of productivity gets driven out of the central government right into the locality. It's at that point, I think, that there's some hope for the future, because human beings are, you know, they're going to figure out a way to duck and cover and move through all the obstacles that the centralization people want to put in their way. So I think the other thing that's going to happen, and again, this is a long-term prognosis, but I think the thing that's going to happen is that we're in a kind of a paradigm shift globally in terms of economic and financial order. You're going to see a return of nation states bucking this global centralization trend, but I think this is going to spread to localities and regions as well, and you're going to see more and more of what we've seen kind of in dribbles and drabs, where you have this state or that province cutting deals with this Chinese company or that Russian company and so on and so forth. And that's going to be, I think, the model to look for.
So one of the good news on the horizon as well is we know technologically there is potential for enormous drops in the cost of energy because of breakthrough technology. Now, it's a big adjustment for the fossil fuel industries. And we've seen the coal companies in the United States, all the large coal companies, essentially go bankrupt.
Right.
So, but ultimately that drop in the price of energy could be very, very good news for everybody. I also wanted to bring up the volatility, because one of the things you're noticing, we published on the links for the top news trends and stories, one of the big accounting firms' surveys of the annual global CEOs. And everything, all the feedback I get from CEOs, whether it's a survey like this or talking to CEOs, they are dealing, Joseph, with an unbearable amount of volatility, of uncertainty. You know, for if you're running a plant that's shipping into Europe, in England, you're now got a nightmare on your hands.
Yep.
And so if you look at, you know, not centralization without markets is putting all of them in a position where they have these huge, complex global operations. But if you're not grounding in market, it means these changes can be nightmarish. And I believe it's seriously cutting into profitability and productivity.
Absolutely.
So I don't think the corporations are enjoying any of this. Some are. But I think this is a nightmare if you're a CEO of a big multinational corporation.
Yes, I agree. I agree. And I don't think ultimately that Mr. Global has helped the situation here. And I think you've put your finger on something that we have to watch for here. Because if you're the CEO or, you know, even senior management in a corporation, a global corporation that is actually moving goods from one place to another, you're representing a certain aspect of capitalism that is increasingly out of touch with the central bankers and their
right.
kind of finance capitalism. And I think this is the other major factional infight that we're going to see emerge between corporations that are actually doing or producing something, you know, be it
right.
be it Disney or General Motors. You're going to see a huge fight between them and the finance capitalists, in other words, the banks.
Right.
This I think it's been looming now for a decade. There's aspects of this factional infighting that you can see in these trade agreements, the TTP and the TIP with Europe. I think this is going to increase, Catherine, and I think it may represent a good thing if handled properly, if they can really drive home the importance of actual freedom of markets. Which the finance capitalists peculiarly are the ones choking.
Right.
they've rigged LIBOR rates. They've rigged the commodities markets, particularly the bullion markets. So I think you're going to see this emerge too.
Let me get back to the where I think the power is shifting out of finance and into food. You know, I've always
yes.
believed that food would be the new oil standard, but and we just started in the second quarter. We introduced a whole series called the Soleri Food Series.
Yes.
But we saw the Russian state move ahead
yes.
with their ban on GMOs. Maybe if you could tell us a little bit about that.
Oh, wow. I'm so glad that you included that story, because I've been arguing for years that if the BRICSA bloc was smart, it would capitalize on
right.
the growing opposition to GMOs. That it would make it would transform the GMO issue into a geopolitical issue. And this, if you have watched Mr. Putin very carefully, and the Russian Duma, for that matter, or the Russian Agricultural Ministry, this is precisely what they're doing. Russia is now a major wheat exporter. You know, and turn the clock back, Catherine, just four decades. You and I both remember when the Soviet Union would have to buy wheat from America. So in other words, agriculture is coming back in Russia precisely because the government has stepped out of the way, but the government is also ensuring that their food supply isn't going to be contained with, you know, gobs of glyphosate and Roundup and so on and so forth. They've put a ban on GMOs. Watch for this to explode. I think the Russians have played their geopolitical card here very, very shrewdly. At the same time, you see these mergers like Bayer and Monsanto. You know, Bayer wants to buy up Monsanto, and boy, what a combination, huh? You've got IG Farben and Monsanto. I think this is
well,
this
but it
is
shows
crucial.
how much failure Monsanto has been taking in the marketplace.
Oh, yeah.
Because for Monsanto to be down enough for Bayer to pick it up, that's extraordinary.
Yeah,
it shows real weakness on the part of Monsanto.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. And it shows, you know, karma does work. Their
right.
their policy and aggressiveness to farmers that didn't want GMOs, or, you know, it's coming home to roost. And you know, I say good. The right. other thing that you watch the Russians doing, since we're talking about food, is we might as well think of vaccines in a certain sense as food. You and I talked a great deal about vaccines and the cost of vaccines, the link of vaccines to autism and so on, and the cost to families that are afflicted with an autistic child.
Right.
Mr. Putin, if you look at him, he has been himself personally talking about the vaccine issue and pointing out the West and particularly the United States as being an example of countries captive to the dictates of corporate big pharma and polluting their own children with stuff
right.
that's harming their health. So
right.
I look for not only GMO geopolitics coming out of the BRICSA bloc and Russia, I think you're going to see some vaccine politics being internationalized. And they're
right.
going to take direct aim at these big corporations and the mercantilist policies that they've got governments in the West to go along with. So they're going to lead a revolt. Russia has been playing, it's intriguing to watch, Russia's been playing a soft card power game in the last few years with those currents of Western society that are against these policies of their governments. So Russia's positioning itself, what I'm saying, is to be the international spokesman for those concerns. And this is very, very clever. This is only going to grow. I think it's hugely significant. We're going to see this movement spread from Russia. I fully expect, Catherine, that you're going to see these Russian initiatives begin to affect and influence countries like India, where you've seen not only Monsanto go in there and basically disrupt Indian agriculture. You're going to see the same thing happen with vaccines. There have been stories of tests in India on Indian children being sponsored by Bill Gates that have apparently produced some effects on the health of children in India where these tests were conducted. You're going to see stories like this begin to hit, and right. Again, the result of it is going to be America will start losing some very powerful and significant friends. We have to change the way we've been doing business. We have to change the way that government and business have been related to each other in this country. We've become essentially a fascist country where the government's nothing but a front for big corporations and what they want. We have to go back to a sane regulatory culture in this country rather than turn over our regulatory agencies
to the corporation.
Well,
I hate to tell you right now, the DARK Act is being pushed through the Senate to try and trump the Vermont GMO labeling laws.
Right.
So there's no indication right now in the United States that anybody intends to change anything.
No, I'm not saying that's going to change overnight.
Right.
But I do think that the more, what's going to happen is that the more they try and pursue these mercantilist policies and the more these policies can be shown independently by other nations to be bad for health or bad for the environment, for your income, as you've been arguing. And
right.
The more this happens, the more you're going to see movements of resistance and revolt grow. And as a result of that, ultimately the system is going to change. It's not going to change fast in this country because the system is too corrupt and has been put into play for too long. But again, I think the result here is moves back to local sovereignty are going to catch on big time. I think you're going to see states doing what Colorado did 20 years ago in the wake of the Waco mess. I think you're going to see states passing resolutions asserting their sovereignty under the 10th Amendment. I think increasingly there is the possibility of states in this country simply refusing federal mandates because they're running out of money and the federal
right.
government's they running
can't
out of money.
It's the same thing as the EU regulation. They cannot
exactly.
afford it. Now, one thing I do want to point out is we are watching wholesale starvation in Venezuela right now.
Yes.
And if I was going to recommend to any governor, you know, sort of anything he needed or she needed to pay attention to right now, it would be the cost of not having food sovereignty.
Exactly. Exactly.
It's a very dangerous place to be.
Exactly.
Right.
Exactly.
Okay, well, that ends our economy and financial markets section.
Mm-hmm.
So, Joseph, just, you know, give us a one-minute summary. The second quarter, what happened in the economy and financial markets? What to you was the most important?
Oh, beyond any shadow of a doubt, the Brexit vote.
Right.
I think that may well end up being the story of the decade.
Right.
I think it's hugely significant from the standpoint of economy, from the standpoint of finance, from the standpoint of political philosophy. Just how much centralization do you want? Just how much regulation do you want? Do you want to turn it all over to supranational, unelected boards of corporate commissioners? Do you want to defend the values and monuments of your culture and tradition? I think this was a huge, huge thing in any way you slice it, financially, geopolitically, culturally, and it's going to spread. It's going to spread.
Yeah.
I think you're looking at the beginning to a certain extent, of the end of Mr. Global in the centralized model. I think you're looking at the beginning of the end of that. And like you, I think you're looking at the beginning of the end of unipolarism.
Well, I don't think you're looking at the end of Mr. Global, but I think you are definitely looking at the end of the centralization model is now
right.
going to have to be obedient to both the technology and the economics of decentralization
right.
and deflation. The
right.
debt growth model is over.
It's going to have to be not only obedient, it's going to have to be cognizant of individual sovereignty. It's going to have to be cognizant of culture. You know, they've been playing fast and loose with culture with this immigration crisis, but
right.
I think those days are over. I think people have had enough. They're not going to go along with it anymore. It's, you know, this has been clear in England. It's clear with some of the statements of Mr. Trump. It's clear in other statements that you see coming out of European political leaders. This is going to spread, and rightly so. You know, this model that they have been pursuing is basically an inhuman model. And when you have an inhuman model, nothing works. Governments don't work. Economies don't
right.
work. Finance doesn't work. And that's been the problem.
Well, you've heard me say, you know, money does not make the world go round. Trust makes
right.
the world go round. If there's no trust,
exactly.
the money's worthless.
Yep,
right?
Exactly. Exactly.
Okay,
and
well, Joseph, great.
Mr. Global, no one trusts them.
It's a mess. Okay, so we turn to the second section of news, trends, and stories for the second quarter wrap-up. And our next topic, Joseph, is geopolitics and the shift to the multipolar world.
Mm-hmm.
We certainly introduced what's happening with Brexit, but there's a lot more going on as well.
Oh,
and
yes.
you pointed out a fascinating story to me the other day, and that is the deterioration in the relationship between the U.S. and Israel.
Yes, yes. That's huge.
Yes.
There have been a number of articles now coming out, I think in the Jerusalem Post, also in Haaretz, which is the other big Israeli media outlet. And we've seen several visits now of Prime Minister Netanyahu to Moscow, talking with Mr. Putin personally. This is a huge earthquake. There's just no doubt about it. But the bottom line here that seems to be coming through in these articles coming out of Israel is that Israel, number one, cannot rely any longer solely on America for its, you know, big brother security protection. It has to engage in a much more multipolar way
right.
with the other major powers, and particularly Russia. I found it very fascinating that as this was being done and as Mr. Netanyahu was visiting in Moscow, that the Israeli and Russian militaries have been quietly coordinating with each other in Syria. And I think this is only going to grow. And I think also what you're going to see is Israel is going to make a number of not treaties or anything like that, but at least you're going to have, you know, motu propria, you know, memoranda of understandings between Israel and Russia. And what this means is that the Israelis are kind of quietly negotiating via Russia with Iran and so on and so forth. I think you're going to see this extend itself with Israel and the European nations as well. So Israel is also, you know, recognizing the handwriting on the wall. The unipolar
right.
world is over, and that's a huge, huge thing.
Well, but I also think that the U.S. is seeing the handwriting on the wall.
Yes.
And essentially not doing Israel's bidding.
Right.
I think that's
right.
a two-way street.
Yeah, I agree. Israel was a major pusher for direct American military intervention with Iran. And, of course, the Obama administration dodged the bullet on that one.
Right.
And I think to its credit. But it means, yes, precisely, you're not going to see American policy being dictated to the extent that it was out of Tel Aviv. It's going to be, there's going to be a sea change. in American-Israeli relationships, and I think a huge sea change is underway with Israel and Russia. So that's going to fundamentally alter the
geopolitics. Well, speaking
the
of sea changes, a big one is Saudi Arabia's being cut loose.
Yes, yeah, Saudi Arabia. This has been something I've been blogging about for the past few months.
Right.
Ever since that Atlantic Monthly article interview with President Obama, I think Saudi Arabia is on the menu, and I think they know it. As far as the West is concerned, I mean, it's a barbaric regime. Let's just be honest. And in a modern world, if you were Mr. Global, would you want to be saddled with that regime? You know, it's an ugly blot on your human rights record. It's terribly repressive to women. It's just, you know, there's nothing really good to say about it. And I think the Saudis know this.
the last I saw, the Congress really was planning on passing the 9/11 bill to disclose the 28-page
right
from the 9/11 Commission report about Saudi Arabia's role.
Well, yeah, and then what does Saudi Arabia do? It threatens the United States. Don't do that, or we'll sell off treasuries, and they did sell off some. And then, you know, there was a bit of spin that occurred after that, well, no, that 9/11 report doesn't really finger Saudi Arabia. Well, I go back to the fact that I said before that bill, and I put this in my most recent book on 9/11, that document, apparently, in the words of Senator Graham, names foreign governments, plural, not just government, plural. So in other words, well, who else is named in that document? Now, everybody's going to think Israel, but, you know, I've been saying all along, Israel doesn't really have any national interest to be involved in anything like that, other than perhaps as kind of a secondary on the fringe partner, just to play along and inject American power into the Middle East. But as a major player or in a major role, no. Because if that were ever to come out, it would hurt Israel dramatically, not just in terms of the United States, but with its relationships with any other potential big player on the field. So,
now we just have to stop here. When your 9/11 book came out, I reviewed it on the website and talked about it on the Slary Report. Mm-hmm. But if you could just give everybody 1 minute and explain about the book. I mean, it's one of the finest books on 9/11 yet.
Well, basically, Catherine, on the day of 9/11, I came to the conclusion that, number one, we were definitely watching a planned operation that could not have been pulled off without the involvement of some rogue element within the American deep state. So in other words, there were two levels of the operation. And that, of course, has been the idea that the 9/11 truth movement has basically been putting out there ever since 9/11. But I also came to the conclusion that we were really watching a penetrated operation at that second, deeper level. In other words, there was a third level involved that revealed its presence to the American deep state on 9/11 itself, and it revealed itself in two fundamental ways. First of all, by disclosing the fact that it had penetrated the American federal command structure so deeply that it had the top secret code names for various operations within the FBI, the DIA, CIA, NRO, Marine Intelligence Office, ONI, and, you know, DEA, all across the board. And the thing that clued me into that, Catherine, on 9/11 itself was President Bush at Booker Elementary School, when he gives his first speech, says, well, I'm going to be flying immediately back to Washington. Then he departs the school, and somewhere between then and on the way to Air Force One, a decision was taken, presumably by him and his staff in consultation with Cheney in Washington, that he needed to fly immediately to Barksdale Air Force Base and to Omaha and to Offutt Air Force Base, which are the two command centers for all of America's thermonuclear forces, which were incidentally on that day having a full-up military alert, nuclear alert. We hadn't been on that.
And they were having a golfing outing led by Warren Buffett.
Right. So, that looked to me like what was being done was they were trying to reassert personal presidential control over the command structure, and that meant that there was a third level involved. So that basically is my take in the book. I go into some lengthy arguments and considerations in the book, but that basically is my thesis. There was a third level that was not connected to the American deep state planners of the operation.
Right.
And you had a number of statements of people like Prime Minister Blair who would say some very, very similar things. He came out and said, well, Al-Qaeda is connected to, quote, a global network, unquote. Well, what global network?
Right.
And then there was a Russian economist before 9/11 that was warning of potential attacks on American soil. And she said that this would be the work of a global network of a very few, very powerful men that had assets in excess of $300 trillion. So, in
Yeah,
other
well, you
words,
notice the movies since that I keep talking about, the James Bond movies and Captain America, have the operation within the operation.
yes, exactly.
Right.
Exactly. So the meme is there, and I think that if you look at 9/11 in a certain way, that you have to come to that conclusion, that there was some sort of third element that revealed itself and left the American planners of the operation scrambling to reassert control over the command structure. And then, suspiciously after 9/11, Vice President Cheney disappeared for, weeks, wasn't seen. And I suspect that what he was doing was he was patching the holes, so to speak, in the system, redoing the whole continuity of government planning and everything else. So there's a number of indicators, if you really look hard, that 9/11 was about more than just terrorism or projecting American power into the Middle East. And this is why I say that.
Well, I always thought a big piece of it was financial coup d'etat.
Oh yeah, absolutely. There's a huge financial aspect to 9/11 that I go
Right.
into in the book. So yeah, it's
One of the things we're seeing in Europe that I wanted to bring up in geopolitics is the indications that Germany is expanding its army and integrating it with the Netherlands and other military capacity. So
Right.
they're starting to put together the military capacity to really back up a serious currency.
Yeah, this I think is also another fallout of the Brexit vote. I think to a certain extent the Germans saw this coming.
Right.
And there have been a number of moves, if you've been watching Europe carefully, there have been a number of moves being put into place to create a common European military. This has largely been the brainchild of France and Germany. So in other words, this is going to be a way for those two countries basically to create a Franco-German axis, to use that unfortunate word, and basically put muscle into the European military. Now, the thing here to watch is whether or not France will pull out of the EU. If it does, Germany is going to go ahead with this anyway. Germany is going to expand the Bundeswehr, the German military,
Right.
rather dramatically in the next decade, whether or not anybody else goes along with a common European military. And this goes back to something I pointed out in my book, The Third Way. If you go back to Chancellor Kohl, right after the reunification, he and another Christian Democratic Union leader authored a memorandum that Germany would either have to dominate Europe through the European Union or it would be required to dominate Central Europe in, quote, the traditional way, unquote.
Right.
So what I see happening here, Catherine, is if the EU falls apart, you're going to see the euro go the way of the real and the Confederate dollar. You're going to see a return of the Deutschmark. You're going to see a return of the old exchange rate mechanism, probably beefed up with other countries involved in it besides the Netherlands and Denmark. You're going to probably see Austria, the Czech Republic. In other words, you're going to see the old German dream of Mitteleuropa. So regardless of what happens with these other exit votes, I think you can look at the very strong possibility that Germany is going to pick up the pieces if the European Union shatters. If it doesn't, they're going to go ahead with France and a bunch of the smaller countries and integrate their militaries.
Right.
And I suspect that the geopolitical reasoning here, Catherine, behind the French and German planners' thinking is this is a way for them to create a counterweight to NATO. In other words, it's a way for them, again, to get out of the unipolar world, to get out from underneath Washington's thumb, and assert a much greater measure of sovereignty for themselves. If that happens...
Well, if Germany basically reorganizes the productive North,
right,
into a common,
right,
a common juggernaut,
right,
I mean, Germany has a AAA rating, Denmark has a AAA rating, Norway has a AAA rating,
right.
You know, who knows what Switzerland is? Switzerland will probably tag along in some form, but not in the same currency,
right.
And you're gonna end up with a real powerhouse.
Yeah, you're going to end up with a Germanic bloc if the EU falls apart.
Right.
And if it doesn't, Germany is still going to be very, very much in the driver's seat because you're going to have all those Germanic nations,
right,
and, you know, then poor France. So Germany is going to be very much in the driver's seat. This is, in my thinking, Catherine, a counterweight to NATO. This is a way of combating unipolarism, and again, taking direct aim at Washington and its policies.
So let's talk about the Silk Road, because part of this is, you know, you were watching a rising Asia and access of the wealthiest consumer market in the world, Europe, and
right,
this was getting the U.S.'s hackles up.
Yep,
and
exactly,
we're seeing the build-out on the Silk Road of transportation networks that are rapidly integrating those two economies, Europe and Asia.
Right.
So talk a little bit about what's going on in the Silk Road.
Well, you've just seen Russia, China, and Mongolia ink a deal to create an economic corridor in those three countries, all kind of based around the expansion of high-speed rail and other,
right,
similar transportation infrastructure. This is going to continue. So let's go back here for a moment to Germany and how Germany figures into this. The Germans and Chinese, I think it was just either last week or the week before, inked about $15 billion worth of trade deals. Now, quietly, it's very important for people to understand here, quietly, behind the scenes, German businessmen and lender politicians, a Land in Germany would be basically the equivalent of an American state or a Canadian province. Very quietly, these politicians and businessmen have been journeying to Russia and working out deals. So in other words, the sanctions are being quietly sidestepped in reality by German business. The other thing that you see happening in Germany is you see the cabinet ministers, Mrs. Merkel's cabinet ministers, actually making pronouncements against the NATO exercises, against Russian provocation, against NATO warmongering, and so on and so forth. This is coming chiefly out of Foreign Minister Steinmeier. What this means, Catherine, I think, is, again, I've been arguing this for years, that Germany's economic and national interests lie with the Silk Road and in the East. You know, let's not forget that Germany is also a member of the Asia Infrastructure Investment,
right,
Bank. So what I see all of this boiling down to is the Silk Road is impacting European geopolitics in a very fundamental way. And as a result,
right,
of this, what you see the Germans doing with all of this defense expansion, and I want to get back into this in a moment, with respect to NATO, what you see the Germans doing is expanding their military because, and Steinmeier again said this 2 years ago, the expansion of German trade with the East is going to mean, of necessity, and he pointed this out very bluntly in Berlin in his speech, that Germany's foreign policy is going to have to become much more muscular and, in his words, militaristic. So you're going to see a dramatic expansion of the German military as a consequence of protecting its interests as trade with Asia continues. You're going to see, I think, Catherine, as a result of the Silk Road, you're going to see projections of German power into that area of the world, kind of like Kaiser Wilhelm's old idea of the Berlin to Baghdad railway. It's going to be a very, very similar projection of German power and influence into Central Asia and so on. Now, I want people to look at this military expansion from yet another point of view, because 2 months ago, I think it was, the big German defense firm of Rheinmetall, okay, this is a very old German armaments firm. It's been around since before World War I. Think of it as the other Krupp, all right? Rheinmetall announced a merger with the big French armaments firm.
Wow.
Oh, yes. Yeah, that was a a huge story. I forget what the French firm's name is, Nexus, Nestor, or something like that. It begins with an N. And, you know, basically the French firm is kind of a cartel of the French armaments makers, you know, Schneider, Cresso, Dassault, Mirage, and companies like this. Well, I think this is prelude. That was a prelude to this European integrated military structure, because it's France and Germany getting together and saying we're going to standardize our equipment, basically.
Right.
What I think is going to come out of this, Catherine, is NATO is going to go the way of the Holy Roman Empire.
Right.
NATO is going to become a paper entity. It'll remain on the books as a legal entity until it just becomes so moribund down the line that some Bonaparte puts the end to it, you know, formally and once and for all.
Right.
I think what this means is if you integrate what's been happening with these trade deals between Russia and China, Mongolia, Iran, if you look at the trade deals between Germany and China, if you look at what the German businessmen have been doing behind the scenes with Russia, what this means is that you're going to see, like it or not, in the next 10 to 20 years, you're going to see a fundamental shift of Europe geopolitically, and the Atlantic Alliance as we've known it since the end of World War II is basically going to go the way of the dodo bird. It's going to die. And Europe will be,
you know, resounding rejection. There are many people in America who'd love to see NATO go.
Oh yeah. Yeah, you know, yeah. You've had this coming out of certain elements within the Republican Party in the last two elections. Ron Paul, now Donald Trump, questioning the value of NATO. The bottom line is, you know, NATO has become an excuse for the empire to wage war wherever it wants to,
right.
And the Europeans are simply tired of it because it's putting them at risk. Now, the interesting thing
Catherine, you know, we had the Saker and Orlov and one other fellow Russian living in America come out with a warning, saying that. You know, essentially, the U.S. was headed for a nuclear war with Russia. Now, I wasn't 100% certain that's true, but it certainly looks to me like part of the politics of Brexit is people saying, no, we don't want to go that way.
Well, of course not, you know, because Europe would be on the front lines. And I think the prospects of nuclear war are not as dire as the Saker is making out. I think it's definitely possible. But, you know, there. On the other hand, you have the Russian foreign minister, Mr. Lavrov, saying, you know, responding to that whole thing and saying, no, that's not going to happen. Nobody wants that.
Right.
The key here in this whole Silk Road geopolitics European conundrum is Eastern Europe.
Right.
Because if you look at what's been happening, America has been quietly rebasing to the east in Europe.
Absolutely.
And What I think they're doing is they're trying to assuage Western European and Central European fears about the presence of those American bases by toning down that presence and shifting it eastward. Now, the East European countries, if you look at what they've been saying and how they're responding to this whole development, you know, it's the same old post-Versailles madness. You know, they're squeezed in between two extremely powerful countries with gigantic military potential, in Germany's case, or a gigantic military in Russia's case. And they're looking at this and saying, well, we need protection. And the problem geopolitically here, Catherine, that is different from World War One, and I'm very worried about it, is that prior to World War Two, what did we see? Well, we saw France creating the cordon sanitaire, you know, the sanitary cordon around Germany in Eastern Europe, with the creation of nation states like Poland and Lithuania, Latvia, Estonia, and, you know, Romania. That was their cordon sanitaire, and France had trade and alliance agreements with those countries. But when World War II came along, France, you know, and England, which had guaranteed Poland, had no ability whatsoever to project any military power into Poland to prevent the German and Russian invasion. What America is doing here, then, under the auspices of NATO, I think is something highly dangerous, because we're putting bases in those countries where, if it did come to a war, if Europe is not going to be a reliable ally, then what we're doing is we're putting people in the squeeze between Europe and Russia. This is not a good thing. I think really what we need to look at in terms of the future for possibilities here is, I think you're going to see Russia take the lead in trying to offer some sort of mutual reassurance treaties to those Eastern European countries. And they may come in the form, and I suspect they will come in the form, of some sort of trade deal with the requirement that some of the bases be cut down in their presence. I think this is going to be a long-term thing to look for. And it's going to be, I think it's going to be pitched to them in terms of, you know, join in on the Silk Road expansion projects.
Right.
This is an inevitability. And American basing there, I think, is kind of a desperation move to prevent that from happening. Ultimately,
well, here's the thing. The more you shorten the supply lines on the Silk Road, the greater productivity
right.
grows.
Exactly, exactly.
And the greater prosperity grows. One
right.
of the things
exactly.
I wanted to point out was, when I was in Australia, a point I heard on numerous occasions was the fact that, let me just give you the quote, convergence is an Asian phenomenon. What they mean by that is, if you look at what's happening in the emerging markets, the Asian countries are moving towards parity with per capita incomes in the Western world.
Yes.
But the Southern Hemisphere is not.
Right. Right. Well, you know, this goes directly to the major geopolitical shifts. Let's go back to Eastern Europe for a moment.
Mm-hmm.
I think the American rebasing effort here is a desperation move to prevent the Silk Road influence from going so far as to suck those countries into it. I think ultimately it's not going to work. Now, you mentioned the Southern Hemisphere. It's very interesting to me, Catherine, that President Obama a couple of months ago made that visit down to of all places, San Carlos de Bariloche. If you've been reading my books, you'll know the significance of that.
Right, I mean, I haven't even brought up what's going on in the bottom of Argentina.
Well, yeah, but I think that was partially in response to the fact that, if you've been watching the moves that the Chinese have been making in Latin America, they've been offering trade deals like crazy.
Right.
And
yeah, I mean, the Chinese are running around the world offering carrots, and the U.S. is running around the world offering sticks.
Sticks, exactly.
Right.
And this is the problem. You know, we'd better start offering something other than a stick.
Right.
Because the more we offer the stick, the more those countries are going to pull away. Now, fortunately for America, they have a kind of a pro-American president in Argentina now.
Right.
But I'm strongly suspicious that there may have been some American connivance in getting rid of Ms. Kirchner, because she was not a friend for various reasons. But ultimately, we have to have, again, this is going back to what we discussed previously about productivity. We've got to produce something that we can offer to the world other than drones, bombs, and tanks.
And pornography. Don't forget pornography.
Pornography and bad music. Or McDonald's, you know. We've got to become a workshop again, you know, be it in the arts or making nice automobiles that are cheap and so on and so forth. Otherwise, we're finished. And the problem here is China is offering the Southern Hemisphere a way out from underneath the American thumb. And where China goes, Russia isn't far behind either. Look at where, you know, the constant Russian engagement with Indonesia. They are trying.
Well, the way for
the
Chinese to keep everybody employed is to basically finance the globe.
Right.
And that's why it's so important to them to get their currency into the SDR, because to get it liquid through London. Notice again, London. The more they can build out a global currency, the more they can finance the world the way they financed EBT Nation in the United States, you know, to build their manufacturing. That's how they keep everybody employed.
Don't forget that China also opened up, allowed Chinese bonds to be exchanged and traded on the Frankfurt Bourse in renminbi.
Right.
So, you know, they're pressing very hard. And I think what you're going to see, and you're seeing this with Obama's response to the Chinese initiatives in Latin America, I think what you're going to see is continuing, I would say, even kind of urgent Chinese presence in not only Latin America, but in Africa. And again, response in Africa, you know, we set up Africa, you know, CENTCOM in Africa. So our response is military. The Chinese response is, well, let's build roads and hospitals.
Oh, but it's interesting because, you know, I rarely say a lot of nice things about the president, but I have to tell you, Obama has basically, what he was expressing in the Atlantic article was, in the Atlantic interview, we do not have any more time or money to get mired down in the Middle East. We have to just get out and get moving into partnership in the parts of the world that are growing and getting things done.
Yes, yes.
And he was basically arguing for let's go productive instead of going around in circles and losing money and blah, blah, blah.
Yeah, well, he's right, you know.
Yeah, he is right. He is right. And I think that's why they did the Iran deal. They said it's time to leave.
Yep.
Enough
is
enough. Okay, so speaking of unproductive things, I want to turn to the U.S. presidential campaign.
Oh, do we have to?
that is in my exact feelings. I will say this. If you study soft revolution and what basically the U.S. administration and intelligence agencies have been doing around the world, they've been encouraging, using soft revolution, the breakup of other countries.
Yes.
We now have two nominees, or, you know, presumably two nominees, who have about almost a 60% disapproval rating on either side. As you know, I think entrainment contributed mightily to getting them both elected. Are we looking at a breakup of the United States after the inauguration?
Oh, boy.
Are we under attack by the soft revolution, too?
Yes, I think so. Let's be honest here. Washington, D.C., for most Americans, is perceived as being so corrupt that nothing is going to change. And the two political parties have shown themselves, the elites particularly in both political parties, have shown themselves to be so out of touch with the American people that you cannot explain, you know, the phenomenon of a Bernie Sanders or a Donald Trump in any other way. Trump is articulating what Americans sense. You know, they sense something is wrong. They're angry at the multiculturalism. They've had enough of it. Sanders is articulating the other cynicism in that, you know, we're paying all this money and what are we getting for it? Nothing. You know, our roads are falling apart. Our bridges are falling apart. And the empire is going strong with this war and that war. So what are we getting out of it? Now, again, you know, I'm not a Sanders supporter. I'm not a Trump supporter. but at least they're articulating some cynicism. What's interesting to me, you know, when you pose the question of a breakup of the United States, I really do think that that is a possibility in the cards. I don't mean in terms of actual secession of states, but I do think in terms of states being much more assertive in terms of their sovereignty and simple refusal to go on with federal mandates. I think it's coming to the point that the states are just going to have to say no to Washington, D.C., and some
well,
already
if the,
are.
Well, if, frankly, Joseph, if the U.S. loses reserve currency status,
mm-hmm.
so say Brexit, if I'm right, that there's a good chance Brexit turns out to be the beginning of the end,
mm-hmm.
you know, this plays out for within the next administration. So by,
yes.
you know, 4 to 8 years, you've lost your status. And then the question is, or, you know, it's clear you're significantly on your way. And
yeah.
then you've lost the one thing you had to buy the states back into the program.
Right, exactly.
So you've lost your hook.
Yep. Yeah, you're going to see states, particularly the more powerful ones in the short term, like Texas and so on, you're going to see states begin to assert themselves and make deals directly. But there are other stories that people need to be aware of here that's going on in the United States, particularly if you're overseas and you don't understand American politics or constitutional law. I've been watching, I haven't blogged about it much, Catherine, but I've been watching state movements of one form of revolt or another for the last few years. And this began, of course, with Arizona trying to close down the borders and you know protect the borders as far as Arizona was concerned. And then it spread to states passing resolutions in their state legislatures that the only constitutional money is coin. You know,
right.
this is these little movements have been popping up here and there in very weird places, you know, states like Montana and so on and so forth passing these laws. You find pushback from the states with regard to abortion. We just had a major case decided by the Supreme Court that was brought against the state of Texas. But the really interesting thing to me was the state of Texas in the last year has approved a creation of a Texas bullion deposit bank. Okay.
Right.
And the state of Texas also served notice, kind of like Germany, to the Federal Reserve that they want their gold back. Okay.
Right.
Now, to me, Catherine, that has all the hallmarks of preparation for a de facto secession. Okay.
Oh, I think so.
Yeah. Yeah. I really do. And these things, these types of things are going to expand and continue forward. I think the other thing that's putting states in a bind is Obamacare. States that can't afford it are, you know, they're going under. I think the pushback is going to come, and it's going to come from the states. Now, the thing that I'm very worried about is this idea that you hear in some circles of calling a constitutional convention. I think that would be the absolute worst thing to happen because the current American
I'll tell you my number one fear in this whole 2016 presidential campaign
mm-hmm.
is that they're working their way up to a constitutional convention.
Yeah, me too.
And that's why I think what is unbelievably important is what happens in terms of House and Senate control.
Yeah, I agree. To put it bluntly, a constitutional convention would be a disaster for two reasons.
Right.
Number one, the current political class is far too stupid to come up and far too progressive and centrist and so on to come up with a constitution that would be at all an improvement in terms of recognition of fundamental divinely granted human rights. Okay.
Right.
We're not granted rights by the Constitution. We're granted rights by God. The Constitution merely recognizes it. But these people in the American political class, as far as I'm concerned, or as far as I can tell, are fundamentally godless. They may, you know, they may pimp God on the political stump, But in terms of their actual personal philosophy, you know, it doesn't really have any play in their personal life or thinking. So I think it would be a disaster from that point alone. But number two, we need to go back to the actual Constitutional Convention in 1787, where you had people that were mandated to basically come up with fixes to the Articles of Confederation. And what they gave us was a whole new constitution that they worked out in secret. Right. And again, you know, as far as I'm concerned, looking at it from my kind of arch-libertarian point of view, is you had a bunch of oligarchs getting together and creating an instrument that served their own interest and imposed it on the rest of the country. And I urge Americans once again, don't just read the Federalist Papers, read the Anti-Federalist Papers, and look at how much they're talking about money in those,
right. Because
that's what it was all about. So I think a constitutional convention would be disastrous, because you would have basically a political class which is centrist already and unfortunately largely progressivist in its philosophies.
States to have financial conventions and figure out
how
we can use gold and silver as a currency and how we can create local currencies.
Yes,
that's what we need.
Yes, that's what we need, and I think that's what Texas is all about. And I think this is what is behind some of these other state resolutions affirming the current constitutional requirement that Congress alone has the power to make and coin money. In other words, it's a bullion-based system. So I think there's thinking, at least in some of the states, along these lines. I think that if we look at the election and kind of do a bit of prophecy here, or attempt to predict, if things play out well, you're going to see states asserting their sovereignty under the current constitutional system and telling Washington, you know, to take a hike in terms of these federal mandates. There were Supreme Court cases about 20 years ago. I remember a case of New York versus the federal government, where the federal government wanted to store a bunch of nuclear waste and was requiring New York to do it. And New York said no, and they won. And they won because they argued their case under the 10th Amendment. So I think if we look to the current Constitution and look at what may fall out as the dollar loses its grip on reserve status, is that the states could conceivably reassert a much greater degree of sovereignty in the face of the federal government than they currently do. And the other thing I think that we can expect, if that happens, is, as I said, you're going to see states working to create regional economic financial agreements. You're going to see them working directly with foreign governments and countries. I'm thinking of the Canadian Prime Minister of British Columbia that worked out agreements with China for a bourse in Vancouver. So I think this sort of thing is going to take place.
I really want everybody to pay attention to their local election this time around.
Yes, yes.
Because it's going to matter who your governor is, who your state senator is.
Yes, absolutely, absolutely.
And House
it's
representatives
hugely,
are, who your mayor
who
your
is.
Your mayor
is.
Could be very important.
Well, the other thing that people need to be aware of locally is corporate commissioners, county clerks, things of this nature are going to be hugely important in the next 8 years. We see the same thing in Germany. You know, the German states, the lender in Germany, as I mentioned before, the politicians are you know, saying, forget you, Ms. Merkel, and forget you, Berlin. We're going to go and negotiate directly with Mr. Putin ourselves. I think this movement's going to spread to the United States. It's an inevitability. But for crying out loud, people, don't fall for this idea that in order to fix the system, we have to go back in and tinker with the system itself. We need to start obeying the Constitution and understanding what it's really all about.
Let's enforce the Constitution. We don't need to change it. Let's enforce it.
Yeah, yeah, exactly.
I wanted to read my favorite quote on the campaign so far from Peggy Noonan in the Wall Street Journal writing. Let me just read this. Because my country is in trouble, because I felt anguish at all the estrangements, because some things that shouldn't have changed, because too much is being lost, because the great choice in a nation of 320 million people may come down to crazy man versus criminal.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So here's my concern. My concern is we've got two nominees with almost 60% disapproval rate each. Mm-hmm. And the message of the election, no matter who wins, particularly if Clinton wins, is crime pays.
Yep, exactly.
Now, how are you going to have a Western civilization, let alone financial markets, if crime pays?
Well, you can't. And this I think, is where the backlash is going to hit from the states. We're already seeing the backlash in terms of states being forced to accept X number of refugees. I read a story about my home state of South Dakota, which was forced to accept refugees. And, you know, it's a small state. It's not powerful or anything like that, so it can hardly buck the trend. But again, if they had had their wits about them, the state attorney general should have brought suit under the 10th Amendment against the federal government.
Right.
But, you know, how do you rely on the current Supreme Court? We're dealing with a court that has a track record of huge failure, is almost as old as the Republic itself. I think you've got to see the importance of the states now. And more importantly, mm-hmm. this is something that foreigners need to understand. If you look at the American election demographics of, say, the last 20 years, if you look at it county by county rather than state by state, if you look at it county by county, the blue areas, the so-called, you know, liberal, progressive, democratic areas of the country are clustered around the major metropolitan centers. If you look at the red counties, the so-called Republican, conservative, you know, that sort of thing, if you look at the red counties, they occupy most of the landmass of the current United States. So in other words, American politics is now being driven by a huge demographic change clustered around the cities, in part representative of the influx of illegal immigration and the inevitable gravitation of people that do obtain citizenship to the Democratic Party. So you're also looking at a country that is now badly divided between a few cities determining the course of the nation politically and the vast hinterland in the country. So I think that polarization is only going to continue, and the only way out of that polarization is for the states to reassert themselves. So
right.
How they do so is hugely important, and I couldn't agree with you more. The governors of states...
Well, I think it's going to happen, because if you look at anything that resolves the negative return on investment to taxpayers
mm-hmm.
and the budget game,
mm-hmm.
you're going to have to get a lot more for a lot less.
Yes.
And the federal government's going to have to cut the money back, which means you need to reoptimize by place. And there's
right.
tremendous opportunity if you do. But, you know, what you do in Brooklyn is going to be a lot different than what you do in, you know, in Fargo.
Right, exactly. And the other thing that people need to remember here, too, as states begin to reassert themselves, they have to reassert their sovereignty over healthcare issues. I mean,
right. The
idea that we have a healthcare system that basically is for health insurance companies rather than people, that is passed in the middle of night behind closed doors in an executive session by a Speaker of the House who hasn't even read the bill that tells us we have to vote on it to find out what's in it. This is, to me, the measure of what is wrong with the system. No
right.
law should be a law unless it has been read by the legislator themselves.
Right.
And no law should be a law unless it is originating from the legislator, not a group of lobbyists or a committee of corporations or things like this. It has to originate somehow, and this is the problem. States can reassert control over these issues if they would grow a pair, if I may put it so bluntly, and take back their school systems and so on and so forth from all of these federal mandates that are choking our educational system, choking our culture.
So let me move to our next topic, which gets to the heart about why some of them don't, and that
mm-hmm.
is assassination and covert operations. If you look
yes,
at the Supreme
exactly.
Court decisions over the second quarter, you can start to understand why somebody might want Scalia dead.
Yes, absolutely. Absolutely.
Right.
Absolutely.
So, you know, and we continue to watch false flags go on all quarter long. So, If anything, I would say the dirty tricks are rising, not falling. But what's interesting is if you look at the speed at which that's being noticed and understood.
Yes.
I mean, the more we get these false flags that supposedly promote gun control, you know, the more people who go buy guns get trained and get adamant
right.
against.
Well, the other thing that's happening as a result of all of these assassinations and mysterious deaths and so on is people are waking up to the fact that this can't be right. You know, you can't have this many people dying before crucial Supreme Court decisions and so on and so forth.
Right.
So what this tells me is that the deep state in this country is in a serious snit of panic. They realize it's slipping away from them, that they're losing the people. And high time, too. You know, it's high time they lost the people. But the other thing that I think is that needs to come out of this is that the states themselves, let me give you an example of what you're getting at here with assassination and covert operations. I was in Oklahoma when the Oklahoma City bombing occurred. And it was very interesting to watch the reaction in the state itself on local news versus the national news coverage of the bombing. Because what happened in the state of Oklahoma was that the state itself, there was huge pressure in the state not to buy the public story that was being put out. There was a state grand jury, a state legislative investigation of the whole thing, and the people leading these things were highly suspicious of the narrative, and basically they were shut up. One of the major critics of the federal story was a gentleman who had lost his young grandchildren in the daycare center. And of course, he ultimately dies, guess what, of cancer.
Right.
But the residual effect of that has been that people simply do not trust the deep state in this country. So this is where the states need to step up and again, grow a pair. And realize that anytime something like this happens on their territory, they have a duty and an obligation under their state constitutions to investigate these crimes to the full extent that they are able and to publish their story. And if it's an opposition,
well, they need the support of the
narrative,
population to do that.
Pardon me?
They need the support of the population to do that.
Yeah, well, that's the other thing. People have to wake up and realize that you're not going to solve the problem in D.C. You're going to solve it in, you know, Pierre or Austin or Boise
right.
or wherever. That's where it gets solved.
So let me bring up the soft revolution thing. We just did a great interview with Wayne Mattson about soft revolutions.
Mm-hmm.
And I would say probably the most offensive aspect of soft revolutions globally and soft weapons was the Fed's guidelines on transgender access to school bathrooms.
Oh, yeah. It's
been unbelievable.
It's nuts. I know people that have stopped going to certain department stores that support all of this nonsense.
Right, me too.
I even know homosexual and transgendered people that are against it. So, you know, again, this is the federal government being so out of touch. It's out of touch even with the constituencies that they assume are going to go along with all of this.
Right.
And also, I think to a certain extent, that issue is so nuts. I mean, Catherine, it's another assault on our humanity. It's another assault on the innocence of our children to try and sexualize them and get them to identify. Well, how do you feel today? Do you feel like a little boy, or do you feel like a little girl, or somewhere in between?
Well, the other thing is, if you look at the amount of shadow work it is for the educational system and the
yes.
state attorney generals, you're talking
yes.
about, you know, hundreds of thousands of hours wasted on
yes.
a topic that, you know, there are many important topics. This is not one of them.
Yes. This is a place, again, where the people and the states just have to stand up and say no. This is nuts. And I think another part of this, Catherine, is that this is an issue that's created to be a distraction, too.
Right.
Because it's a distraction from the fact that we're facing some real tough economic and geopolitical choices in this nation.
Right.
And to be arguing about whether or not a little boy can go into a little girl's bathroom in school is nuts.
Let me skip to the next one. I've had several friends and colleagues come back from Asia recently, and I've asked them, you know, what is on people's mind? And they say, you know what the number one topic in the news is? South China Sea.
Yes. Yes. Now, again, if you look at the South China Sea issue, what concerns me, Catherine, is if you've been following the Chinese and Russian militaries and the things that they are deploying, new weapons systems and so on, I have to question the wisdom of continuing to build these multi-billion-dollar aircraft carriers when both Russia and China have cruise missiles that have a range of over 1,000 miles that are capable of sinking one of those things. Either we've got weapon systems that are pretty good, or we're investing a heck of a lot of money in great big sitting ducks. And I suspect it's the latter. We need to be concerned about the South China Sea, because I'll tell you what's happening as a result of these claims about China and America trying to ward this off by stationing more and more carrier groups in that region. What it is doing is it's driving Japan, which, you know, again, talk about a country that is managing to alienate some pretty powerful allies, Great Britain, you know, the European powers, and now Japan wants to rearm. And I've been saying all along that the reason that Mr. Abe's government is rearming is not simply to kowtow to Washington's demands that Japan take up a greater burden of the defense of the Pacific Basin. I think the real long-term objective here, as far as the Japanese are concerned, is they, like everyone else, is looking at America and America's politics and America's military and its inability to stabilize any of the regions it has claimed to go into to stabilize in the last 30 years. They're rearming because they are no longer confident of the ability of the United States to maintain their security. And I think they're rearming as well as a counterfoil, not just to China and the United States, but as a means of opening the doorway to some negotiation with Russia. And we've seen this going on, incidentally, some negotiations with Russia to get Japanese involvement in the development of Siberia and all of those vast energy resources there, because, again, that's a much more secure energy supply line for Japan than anything coming through the South China Sea, reliant on America's ability to interdict it.
Right.
So, you know, we're watching a huge geopolitical shakeup happen, and again, I want to emphasize this for all of our listeners in, you know, Australia or the Philippines or Indonesia. Again, it's because American unipolarism has failed utterly in its geopolitical objectives. The only thing it's accomplished is to drive away our friends and allies. And, you know,
did
we can't afford to lose Japan.
On the South China Sea during the second quarter.
Mm-hmm.
And one of the most interesting tidbits was they pointed out that the U.S. began to build the dollar as the reserve currency when they got control of the sea lanes in the Caribbean.
Yes, yes.
And, you know, if China's going to build out its currency, the question is who's going to control the sea lanes in the South China Sea? Because that is the most important trade point on the planet, and of course it's right in the, to the south. So, I think the U.S. pivot and the U.S. desire to keep control of those sea lanes is going to be really at the heart of the currency battle right now.
It's not only going to be at the heart of the currency battle, Catherine, it's going to be at the heart of the American effort to maintain the current alliance system over the next decade or two. And ultimately, Catherine, I got to be very honest, I think it's going to fail.
Right. Well, if the Commonwealth has walked, it's failed.
Yeah. Well, if the
The bell just rung.
Not just the Commonwealth. The problem is if you lose reserve currency status, you can't afford multi-billion-dollar aircraft carriers that may or may not be a good investment to begin with. You can't afford a $2 trillion mutual defense fighter that every country, you know, that we're allied with has had a finger in that doesn't work. It doesn't fly as well as fighters that are older and produced much more cheaply by our potential enemies. So in other words,
let's turn to the last and possibly biggest political hot potato in the
sure.
category of geopolitics, and that's immigration. Because immigration is not just a
huge hot potato
in Europe, it's a huge hot potato in the United States. It will be probably the number one issue in the election after the economy, and it's all caught up with the economy. But immigration is a big question more and more around the world.
Yes, yes. Well, I've got to be frank. I think we need to start calling it the multicultural issue rather than the immigration issue. Because it's one thing to have immigrants that share or come from a culture that has similar values, that are part of the Western tradition. You know, everybody gets up in arms about Hispanics. I'm not up in arms about Hispanics, you know, because they're coming from the same common culture. They're hard workers, you know, they have family values. They're not on board with all the kookiness that we see coming out of the progressives, although they tend to vote for the party representing it.
Right.
But I think that's only because of kind of a knee-jerk reaction.
Right.
But to me, the real issue isn't immigration, it's multiculturalism. Are you going to come to this country, regardless of where you're coming from, and live under its laws and insist that everybody else live under its laws? Or are you going to end up in a ghetto advocating, you know, like I heard one woman today on the news, a Muslim woman dressed in, you know, her canvas burlap sack with her little slits for eyes, talking about how good of a thing it was for Mateen to go in and shoot up a gay bar in Orlando because, you know, this isn't good. Well, I'm sorry. If that's your attitude, give the lady a parachute and let her jump out over Saudi Arabia and she can live in her paradise. That's the issue, I think.
Are you sure she wasn't an actor paid by the U.S. government?
Well, she may have been an actor, sure. Sure. But this is the point. We cannot have a culture where we are literally committing suicide by inviting and protecting people that don't assimilate into that culture. If you know, this is my big problem. To me, it's not an immigration issue. It's this whole cultural Marxism problem that's the issue of using culture so antithetical to what it is you want to break down so that you can install yet more centralized regulatory bureaucracy.
Well, part of the problem is you're debasing your home culture at the same time.
Yes,
so you're debasing your culture instead of building it up, and then you're adding in these complexities, some of which are, you know, basically third world cultures.
Yes, exactly. Not just third world, but, you know, medieval and barbaric and unreconstructed and unreformed.
Right.
That's the problem. It's not going to work. You can't have a culture that way. And when you can't have a culture, culture is the basis. You know, culture comes from cultus in the Latin. Basically, culture means what's your basic sort of unwritten, taken-for-granted, religio-philosophical view of the world. That's what it means.
Right.
You can't have a functioning judiciary. You can't have a functioning system of laws. You cannot have a functioning economy. You cannot have trust when you have no cultural agreement, and that's the bottom
line. Well, trust depends on the covenant, and the covenant
exactly.
is first and foremost cultural. It's not legal.
Exactly.
Legal is the next layer.
Yes, exactly.
Yeah.
You know, you cannot have bureaucrats trying to lay down rules and regulations for how everybody's to get along. That won't work. It
right.
didn't work in the Soviet Union. It's not working in Venezuela, you know, and on we could go. And this is what I find so scary about people like Bernie Sanders, you know, who openly calls himself a socialist. Well, if that's what you want, move to Havana. or China, you know, if that's
well, but I'm a capitalist. I believe in markets, but I've never seen them tried in the United States.
Yeah. Well, that's the other problem. You know, capitalism, the way you and I are thinking about it is close to the people. Capitalism,
right.
the way the Republican Party thinks about it, is Wall Street and J.P. Morgan and, you know, trading securities and so on and so forth.
Assassinating anybody who disagrees with that.
And assassinating anybody who disagrees with it.
I would just like to close the geopolitical section by noting that
for my whole life,
up until about 1996, every time you turned around, somebody was using the expression, it's a free country.
Yes.
And 2016 has been the first year where not only have I never heard the expression, I've never heard anybody reminisce about the fact you don't hear it anymore.
Yeah. You can tell the change in our culture by the shift in the language of political discourse.
Right.
That's the problem. The language is the key that something very profoundly is wrong with the political system. No one is talking about the Bill of Rights. No one is talking about freedom.
Well, I don't think that's true because I know you are and I know I am.
Well, I mean in the political class. That's
right.
That's the problem.
Right.
What little I heard from the Republican presidential debates, there was no talk about freedom. There was no talk about preservation of the culture and what gave birth to this country, you know, which was a long process going back centuries. There was none of this, and when you do hear talk like that from people, it's usually of a very kind of plastic jingoistic kind that our country, right or wrong, you know, we're going to rush out and defend America against all of our enemies that, you know, we've managed to create it. So in other words, there's no critical thinking among that crowd.
Right.
So
I have to tell you, I'm to celebrate July 4th. I'm getting on a plane on Thursday. I'm flying to New York, and I'm going to see Hamilton on Friday. And then on Saturday, I'm going over to the Met to see Sleeping Beauty. So I'm going to celebrate the writing of the Constitution. I don't know if you realize it, but my company, Hamilton Securities, was named after Alexander Hamilton.
Alexander, yeah, I do realize that.
Which is the last time I ever name a company after a politician who gets shot by a New York politician. Since my company also got shot by a New York politician, so... it's a corrupt country, but as long as you're around, Joseph, and we can talk to you, then it's still a sane country. I love the expression from Scripture, where two or more gathered in my name, there am I.
Yep, there am I in the midst of them. Yeah, well, this is the other thing. I think you've hit your nail on something very important there. You have to seek out people of a common mind.
Absolutely.
And engage with them. Because there's so much disengagement now that I think that's part of the problem. Everybody's in their own little cave, you know, and afraid to speak out.
To close off the geopolitical section, let's not look back at the second quarter. Let's look ahead at the third quarter. What do you think is going to be the most important thing happening in the third quarter in geopolitics?
In geopolitics, oh boy,
mm-hmm.
I say look to three principal areas. I think you're going to have to look very closely at countries clustered around the South China Sea, in particular at Indonesia, and how
mm-hmm.
they are responding to China, what any overtures might exist between them and Commonwealth countries like Australia and so on.
Mm-hmm.
So that's one area I would look very heavily at. Obviously, look at Europe and particularly watch very carefully now what the population and movements in France and Germany and Italy, and in addition, you know, the smaller countries, Austria, the Netherlands, and so on, are going to be doing in terms of the EU. I think there's a real possibility that you could see countries like Italy or Spain or Greece or France bolt. If that's the case, Germany's going to pick up the pieces of what remains. So watch Europe very, very carefully. And as always, continue to watch the BRICSA bloc and the Chinese Silk Road developments. I think you're going to see in the next, maybe not next quarter, but at least beginning next quarter and carrying on perhaps for a year or two, you're going to see some very interesting commercial and diplomatic developments coming out of Russia and Japan. I'm almost convinced
right.
of that.
I agree. I absolutely agree.
Mm-hmm.
Well, Joseph, thank you very much. This has been excellent. We certainly live in interesting times geopolitically.
Yep, absolutely. Thanks for having me back on.